Back at it, you and I chatting it up together on a Friday, January the 9th, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today. I open the show urging protesters to use a bit of common sense and stay out of the street in light of reported injuries the night before during an anti-ICE demonstration in Hartford. Connecticut Inside Investigator reporter Mark Fitch dropped by to talk about the latest state payroll numbers and the continuing investigation into Connecticut's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, or PURA. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso had his weekly update while we ended the week on a sports note, welcoming New York Times writer Ken Belson, the author of Every Day is Sunday, How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL into a cultural and economic juggernaut.
So I continue to wonder with the tragedy we saw yesterday. And by the way, there's new video out about that Minnesota shooting. Looks a little bit better for the ICE guy who unfortunately had to fire those shots. But we'll get to that later. But there was some new video released, I guess, within the past couple of hours. It's now making its way across the internet. I got it on a link from our buddy, our pal Eric Erickson, who's on from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. tonight. So look at that. You can Google Alpha News for that video from the point of view of the ICE officer. Now, having said that, that involved a car yesterday. And I'm reading here that apparently there was a protest, a rather boisterous protest, last night at the federal building in Hartford. Now, I read this and I wonder, what is it about protesters that put themselves, and I don't care what you're protesting, I really don't, and I don't besmirch the right of people to protest, but don't be stupid. See, you can protest and be really well versed on a subject, but you can't be a stunod. You can't be, as my people like to say, don't be a gavone. All right? This from the Hartford Courant. At least one person was knocked down by a vehicle and several were pepper sprayed after two vehicles drove out of a federal building's parking garage and into a crowd during a vigil for Renee Good in Hartford on Thursday evening. Well, I have an idea. Get the blank out of the way. Explain. And I know this has been happening for years, but have you ever sat back and thought, well, wait a minute, they're crowding vehicles, they're on roads, and this happened in the wake of George Floyd. Roads were shut down. Like, that made a difference, right? Where am I supposed to come up with the sympathy for people who get hit by vehicles or who get shoved down vehicles when they know what the road looks like? Listen, if you want to protest and scream and yell and call the feds and Trump and any manner of bad word to anybody to do with ICE or Border Patrol, that's fine. Don't get in front of cars. Stay off of the streets. Listen, you can't have it both ways. You can't. You can't go out there screaming and yelling, and then when you get hit by a vehicle, well, if you're in the street, what the F are you doing? I mean, it is mind-boggling here. The vigil in Hartford was taking place on the west side of the Abraham Ribicoff Courthouse on Main Street when the disruption occurred at the back of the courthouse along South Prospect Street. I used to work in Hartford. I know where that is. It's unclear who provoked the confrontation, but witnesses saw two vehicles, a gray sedan and a white van, emerged from the garage. Now, let me stop my narration here. We'll go back to it in just a moment. If I'm protesting and I'm out somewhere, I might look around and say, hey, am I safe here? Right? Oh, wait a minute. There's a garage entrance there. There may be police cars over there. Let me make sure I'm not in a place that's going to tap into my idiocy and harm me or anybody else I'm with. So I just wanted to put that out there. Now, here we go. A large number of people got in front of the gray sedan. Wait a minute. I'm shocked. What? Hey, Chris, can you do me a favor? Can you go online and check to see what happens if people get in front of moving vehicles and the vehicle is moving? I'm not quite sure. Jeez. These people, I know they're passionate. Are they that stupid? And I hate to sound this way because I know there are some people listening, maybe some of whom called yesterday and said, well, I shouldn't say things. Yeah, I know. There are things I probably shouldn't say. But my God, you get to a level of stupidity where you say to yourself, I have to say this. Again, I will read, a number of people got in front of the gray sedan under the impression that a detainee was being taken away, witnesses said. The sedan pushed through the group. One woman was knocked over by the vehicle. Well, let me ask you something. Why in the hell are they in front of a running car? Well, we thought there was a detainee in there. Well, guess what? That's none of your freaking business. Well, you know, we have to protest because, nobody's saying you can't protest. I'd prefer you protest it and not be stupid because then, God forbid, if somebody got hurt there or God forbid if somebody got killed, oh, my God, federal vehicle kills person. Well, geez, you usually, now, I'm not that good at physics and algebra trig and geometry. But even a dolt like me at a quarter past two on Friday, January 9th, even I can say, well, wait a minute now. Probably the best way for me not to get hit by a vehicle is not to be in front of it. Am I right here or wrong? The sedan pushed through the group. Good. One woman was knocked down by the vehicle. Okay, and what was she doing there? I don't know about you, but if I'm protesting anything and I see a vehicle come, you know what I do? I go the other way. Or I put my hands up and say, hey, buddy, take it easy. I'm getting out of the way. Arjun Patel told the Connecticut Mirror, I had to, pick her up to prevent her from getting run over. What are you doing in that position? Why would you be anywhere near a garage or the opening to a garage or a driveway? I don't get these people. One witness said they were pepper sprayed by a masked person who had been behind the vehicle. Well, I have an idea. You don't want to get pepper sprayed. Stay away from where a vehicle has to move. The current continues here. A white van with New Hampshire license plates then drove out of the garage. A protester threw, here's a shock. A protester threw an object at the van, which broke the left rear window. Oh! The van stopped, shifted into reverse, and accelerated, scattering some protesters. Then it drove off north onto Prospect Street. Well, why would the van do that? Well, what do you think? What are the people in the van thinking? They hear a window shatter. Are they worried that the muzzle, the business end of a gun might be coming through there? Look, I'm all for protesting here. I am. But like I said yesterday with this woman, and by the way, there's new video out. Go to Alpha News and look at the video from the point of view of the eyes. And you, what did I tell you? Whenever this happens, once you get 3 or 4 days away from something, the actual story starts to come out. But look, you can protest all you want. God bless you. That's one of the great things we have in this country. We still are the freest country in the world to do this. Even we have allies like England and Canada that have speech codes. You can be thrown into jail and arrested in Canada and the UK for stuff you say, stuff you post online. So, yeah, go ahead and enjoy the freedoms America gives you, but try to do it without being stupid. Well, Paul, that's a little harsh, don't you think? No, it's common sense. I hate to tell you. Stay away from vehicles. It's nuts. It's crazy out there. So I ask this, and Bob will get to you. We have other folks standing by as well. You want to jump in here? 20, and I don't mean to laugh, but what do people think is going to happen when you get near, in high-tension situations, you get near running vehicles? Many vehicles operated by somebody who may not be cool as a cucumber and thinks they're being attacked. What in the heck do you think's going to happen? Can I ask you that? So we begin with this at 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So let's begin with this. This is our question of the day. I tried to word this as evenly as I could here on the program. Is an attempt by individuals to block a motor vehicle an acceptable form of protest? Or is it just plain stupid? That's all. Not telling you you can't protest. But is it acceptable to block motor vehicles, commercial, public, private, or not? Or is it just plain, as I like to say, stupid? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So a person got hit or by, I guess they're okay, by a vehicle leaving the courthouse last night in Hartford, a protest here in Connecticut to what happened, the tragic shooting death of this woman in Minneapolis. And look, you want to go protest, that's fine. God bless you. Go scream and yell. Say the most vile things you want about Trump and about J.D. Vance and about ICE and about Customs and Border Protection. Go right ahead. What are you doing in the way of cars and vehicles? I'm sorry. I have less than zero. Now, technically, that's not possible, less than zero. There's zero. There's zero, and that's it. Although in organic chemistry, you can have minus temperatures. What's Kelvin? Minus 200 and absolute zero, minus 273 degrees. I don't know. I'm sorry. You see where my mind goes here. But I'm reading all these stories in the Current, the Connecticut Mirror. Oh, no. Somebody got hit by a car leaving the federal building in Hartford, the courthouse. Yeah. Well, if you stand in the way of where that car might be coming, chances are, if Sir Isaac Newton was here, he'd probably say, you're going to get hit, and then you break a window on another vehicle, and somebody backs up and pulls a defensive maneuver again. What are you expecting? I don't quite, well, may I do. I actually do understand it because some people are dumb. I'm sorry. Some people are dumb. Not everybody who protests is dumb. Some people who protest are actually very smart and can understand an issue. But getting in front of a car, even the George Floyd thing, when they were blocking highways because of George Floyd, like that helped. When the real reason there, besides the brutal treatment of George Floyd, was a brutally corrupt police department in Minneapolis that still nobody wants to talk about. But having said that, blocking of roads, no, I'm sorry, especially if it's a highway or a major street. What if an ambulance has to get through there? I'm sorry. I don't know what you think, but I asked the question here, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So is blocking a road an acceptable form of protest? You tell me. It's on our Facebook page, facebook.com/voiceofct. What do you think? Blocking a road, screaming and yelling, fine. I don't care. Give the finger, whatever you like. But blocking a road, what do you think? Is that an acceptable form of protest or just plain stupid? And by the way, before we go to the phones here, I'm skimming through the news channels here. Now this video was just released. Everybody's got it from the ICE point of view. All of a sudden now I've seen two of the talking head experts on cable TV going, oh boy, this is a critical form of evidence. You think, Einstein? Really, Dick Tracy? Thanks. And what do I always say about these things? Wait 3 or 4 days before you make any judgments. Use your head. Bob and Weston's with us to kick it off. Bob, how are you? What's up?
Hey, Paul. Three things.
Yeah.
One, you are the voice of reason. That's not the three things. the mayor of Minneapolis and all these other Democrats that are, yeah, they're inciting these people to go out and obstruct.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's illegal what these people are doing, you know, blocking the roads.
You can't block a street. That's illegal and it's stupid, Bob. You're putting yourself in harm's way.
Paul, and what were we taught? I mean, I'm in my upper 60s, and my dad and mom had, you know, they had talks with me, and they said, you respect, you comply, and you help the police whenever you can. Mm-hmm. They are your friends. Mm-hmm. And let's not forget, Paul, some party let 11 million people in, and a lot of them are bad actors, and these brave men and women of ICE and the other law enforcement, they're out there to pick these people up.
And there are millions of people, Bob. There are millions of people who agree with that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's and they incite. So, you know, when you use the word stupid, I think these politicians are out of their minds, you know, because they're causing these people to go out. And, you know, these are mindless people that are out there. And they all they're doing is obstructing what we have to correct.
And Bob, thank you. I do appreciate it. And coming up later, I also have this in the pile of stuff here. You may have heard that there was another shooting in Portland, Oregon yesterday by not an ICE person per se. It was Customs and Border Protection. And again, two alleged Tren de Aragua gang members. I guess they both have police records. And I was screaming at my computer screen last night reading this stuff at the mayor of Portland, the governor of Oregon. The first thing they did, rather than say, hey, let's see about this, they immediately blamed ICE for violence. When, as a lot of progressives do, and I know some people don't like when I say that, well, I'm sorry. As a lot of lefties do, they immediately blame law enforcement, and nobody here took the time to look at the alleged police records of these two. Because, again, for a lot of people, criminals good, law enforcement bad. We always go to the Connecticut Inside Investigator, and one of our main buddies from there, Mark Fitch, for an occasional check-in, because a couple of stories here that caught my eye over the past couple of weeks. Mark, good afternoon, sir. How are you on a Friday? Happy New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year, Paul. It's good that it's Friday. It's,
yeah.
You know, one of those thank God it's Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple things you wrote about, Mark. Number one, numbers are out on the state payroll. The average state worker since Ned Lamont took over, doing quite well, Mark, 35% more, $94,000. But I know there's worry now, is there not? Correct me here, as to what some of the long-term implications here of people making more money, which is good, but what are some of the worries here?
Well, I mean, obviously the Lamont administration is currently in negotiations with the state employee unions for probably another round of raises over the next few years. So, yeah, and they've had 6 years of straight raises. You know, one of the concerns that has been raised to me is that, you know, obviously people get paid more than their pensions are more, right? And we've been, as a state, collectively paying down our pension debt successfully as well.
Sure.
But while we've paid $6.5 million into the state employee pension debt, only like $5.1 billion has actually, you know, it's only the unfunded liabilities have only gone down about $5.1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a few reasons for this. One of them, and probably the biggest one, is that in 2022, we saw a surge of retirements.
Yeah.
But we also did not have a very good market year. We came in, our pension investments on the market came in negative 8%. And that pretty much signifies like a $2.5 billion swing in the wrong direction. So, you know, as we make these payments, there's fluctuations and things like that. But, you know, I mean, the long and the short of it is, you know, people make more money, then their pensions go up. And, you know, the average pension in Connecticut's gone from, you know, it hasn't gone up as much as the pay, but, you know, it's increased. They get, you know, annual, you know, cost of living increases, but you do have some pensioners out there making over 300 grand, about six of them.
Wow. Yeah. I remember until they, and then they readjusted the tiers. I remember that to try and eliminate that. Also, Mark, every time we talk, the continued soap opera, they should make a Netflix series out of it, the Pura situation, still not going away, and still going back to the term of now the former Pura chair, Marissa Gillette. I think you pointed out, and you have been pointing out over the years, that this is still maybe, at least from a legal point of view, a long way from being over. And some of the utilities say, hey, is this right, Mark, that they think the state actually owes them money for some rate increases that were denied?
Well, that's something that could come up, absolutely, yeah. being that Pura and the state admitted to wrongdoing in court.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the utility companies could go back and say, hey, you didn't handle these rate increases properly. But there is also, if I remember correctly, storm repairs that the state owes the utility companies to the tune of like $1.5 billion or something like that. So, yeah there's some big bucks at stake. And, you know, we continue to, you know, rack up charges on the public benefits portion of our bill. And, you know, the story that I did earlier this week is basically the Republicans are asking the Government Oversight Committee to take a look into this whole Pura debacle and see what happened. Whether or not a committee controlled by the Democrats are going to take up a cause that, the you know, take up looking into a agency that, you know, some very key and influential Democrats championed. We'll see. But, you know, the Republicans are trying to make some hay out of it.
Excellent. Mark Fitch, Connecticut Inside Investigator. Check it out. Does some great work and follows up those big stories. Mark, thanks. Good to chat with you. And we'll chat down the road, my friend. Take care.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. There you go. So the Pura is not going away. Not going away. Yeah, what's going on includes Greater Bridgeport. This gentleman briefs us on what he's hearing. Every Friday, right around this time, former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep, mayoral candidate, city councilor, and all-around good guy. He's on Cavone Watch. Chris Caruso is with us. Chris, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Very good. Happy Friday, Paul.
Yeah. Well, you know, Chris, we always have to be, you know, our antenna goes up, right? The Cavones, the Stunads, and everything, right?
Yeah.
Chooches.
Chooches out there,
that's, I can tell that's your favorite. It was always chooches in your house, right? Right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Hey, Chris.
We're choice words, too.
Oh, yeah. No. Because too many. Well, you know, Chris, the people in our tribe will get a kick out of them. The others are like, you know, we can't do that.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Paul.
Hey, we're still a year and change out, Chris, but we're already starting to see some rumblings now for the 2027 mayoral term, and we see George Cruz, or Jorge Cruz, city councilman. Yep. He has opened up an exploratory committee here. He represents what, District 131?
Yeah, 131, which is the south end of Bridgeport, predominantly the south end. There's a little bit of the west end of it, you know, that part of the district, but predominantly downtown. Let's see, the area where the amphitheater is, Seaside Park.
Yeah.
Is included in that district.
So is it unusual, Chris, for somebody, Mr. Cruz or otherwise, to look at a race, what, a year and change out, almost 2 years out, but a year and change out? Is it normal to start this early, or is it good just to get his name out there?
Well, you know, it's very early, Paul, to be honest with you, and there's a lot of space in between now and 2027. A lot of things could happen. I think what he's probably trying to do is get his name out there and hopefully raise money, because that's a very important money message, you know, organization are the three parts of any campaign if you're going to be successful. So I think he's trying to get a message out there, the word out there. But he's also said that if John Gomes, who he backed last time against Joe Gannon, he said that if he himself, George Cruz, doesn't see an opportunity to win, then he would back John Gomes. So we don't know right now. I think it's something where you got to sit and watch and see what's going to develop. But it's a long time from that time to now. And also, when you take stands on issues, you're going to be accused that it's political. You're running for office.
Yeah,
that's why you're doing it. But you know, I guess what he feels, get his name out there. Hopefully, he can build some name recognition. And the other thing of raising money, don't forget, you don't have public financing in municipal races. Probably the one city that does is New Haven.
Yeah,
where they have a matching program, but Bridgeport doesn't have it. Cities can do a public financing program if they want to set it up with certain parameters approved by the state, but Bridgeport doesn't have it. So you've got to go out and raise every bit of what you're going to use in a campaign. And running against an incumbent like Mayor Ganim, he has, you know, a better advantage to raise the money and put together a campaign that's going to require mailers, literature, staffing of a campaign. So it's not an easy task. You know, I ran twice for mayor in 2003, 2007,
mm-hmm.
and probably a good portion of my day is what was referred to as dialing for dollars.
Yeah.
I had to get on the phone. I had to call, I had to call people up. And, I didn't have big contributors, so it was $100 here, maybe $200 there, $250 yeah. there. You know, some gave $1,000, but those were a certain category of people that could afford it. But my campaign was mainly small donors, which is quite a task.
Yeah, Chris, I'll give you credit for that because I worked on a couple of campaigns. It's something I wanted to check the box off, and I did in the 2010 cycle. A couple of names you probably know, but, we'll leave that aside for now. And Chris, I used to sit there, and I was basically doing media and messaging, but, I would marvel at my candidates, the two folks I work for, the guy and the woman I work for a short time, at listening to them ask for money. And, people, Chris, have come to me over the years saying, hey, you've got to talk to you should run. And I said, listen, I would be great on ideas. I think I love to debate policy.
Sure.
I could not ask people. I just the notion of having to ask people to give me money. I can't sure. do that, Chris. And I give you guys and gals who do it all the credit in the world, because I would hear the candidates I was working for and saying, I can't do that. That must be so tough. It really must be tough.
It is, Paul. But, I've had a background involved in a lot of nonprofits over the years, and I would raise money, for those organizations.
Yeah.
Not that I got paid. I was part of those organizations volunteering, and I would raise money for them. And I learned early on, at one time in my life, Paul, I sold vacuum cleaners through the door. And, I learned that you go to the first door and the person says, no way. You go to the second door, no way. You go to the third door, and what happened to me, the person bought two vacuum cleaners, one for herself and one for her daughter-in-law.
Wow.
And so I thought, that's great. Now, went to the next door, I sold some, and, was successful. But the other thing was, I also sold magazines.
Wow.
On the phone magazines. So I had a lot of that training to go into the campaign, but it's very difficult when you're asking money for political campaigns,
mm-hmm.
because some people don't want to give you the money because they don't know if you're going to win and is a poor investment. You have other people don't want to offend the other candidate
yeah.
or candidates running. And then what happens is, I believe in those days, Paul, the maximum you could get from a person was $1,000.
Okay.
So if you started off with the person giving you $100 because that's what they could afford,
yeah.
you had to call again and say, hey, can you give me another $100? Which was the hardest because, when you're going after small donors, you're
yeah.
not going after the big groups, you're tapping into people that have limited income.
Mm-hmm.
But, thank God my years of experience in the political arena, fighting for various causes, I was able to garner supporters that were willing to help fund the campaign. But it was a difficult task. That's one of the reasons, Paul, that I fought so hard to build public financing
yeah.
on the state level. And, it was recent. It was interesting. Some people criticized that. but it was bipartisan. There were Republicans who also voted for it. And which was interesting, Aaron Stewart, who's running, you know, on the Republican primary for governor, she stated she wouldn't be able to do a governor campaign without public financing.
Yeah, and Chris, I wanted to bring that up. We got about a minute left. And kudos to you for doing that, because I talked about it on the air. Aaron qualified. It looks like Ryan Fazio will qualify. And I explained to people, $300,000 for the convention, another, what, $3 million for a primary, and $15 million. And if you factor out, eventually, I guess, you know, we will have a non-rich guy running for independently financing. That's a nice chunk of change. And I applaud you for doing that.
And you know, there, when we built that program, Paul, like for governor, you have to raise $300,000 first. And that what that does is it takes fringe people that are just running because they want to run. It says that you've got to raise the money, which isn't easy to do, to raise $300,000.
No.
I know that Josh Elliott, from what I understand, has raised about $80,000 so far. But, you know, to raise a threshold of like, you know, $300,000 gets you in the game, which is critically important. And the one thing, it doesn't mean that once you hit that $300,000 mark, you don't have to be on the phone asking for money.
Yes.
And that's critically important. The other thing with public financing, you can't take money from contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And lobbyists are limited what they can give you. We originally excluded lobbyists, but the court said we couldn't. So we set a limit. It was like $100 they could give.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant a lot. So what I'm happy about, I always felt, when I was on the city council in Bridgeport, where we had split of a Democrat-Republican, 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans, I always felt that was the best time that I've spent. We got good legislation through, great exchange of ideas, and that's what we need on any level, state level, federal government, is to have a group of people not from the same party. Even though I'm a Democrat.
No, I get it.
It's good to have that exchange, you know?
Yeah, it's the best legislation. Chris, thank you, and kudos to you for the public financing again. Have a happy weekend. Keep away from the chooches, and we'll talk next week.
Take care, Paul.
All right, Chris, thanks. Chris and I on Chooch Watch, Gavone Watch, Stunod Watch, and more. Let's have some fun now. Let's talk what else? Football. How about this? Our next guest spent 14 years in the sports department of the New York Times, primarily covering the NFL. He rejoined the Times business section in 2023 to write about the business of sports. And yeah, that's a business with a capital B. Name of the book, Every Day is Sunday, How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL into a Cultural and an Economic Juggernaut. We welcome Ken Belson to the program. Ken, hi, it's Paul in Bridgeport. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Thanks for being here. We appreciate it. These three personalities, Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, Robert Kraft, the owner, of course, of the New England Patriots, and, of course, the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell. Why did you focus the book on these three gentlemen?
Well, two things. One is practical. You know, there's that law of threes. Three's a good number. It's enough to stick in people's heads. If I went to five or seven, you'd be still reading the subtitle to the book. So that was one thing. The other is that Robert Kraft and Jerry Jones really are the head and shoulders, the two most influential owners even today. They played key roles in the biggest media deals, the labor negotiations since they came into the league, the stadiums they built. They have 9 Super Bowls between them, and both of them have been dubbed the shadow commissioner for their influence on Roger Goodell and to a certain extent Paul Tagliabue before him. So those two were kind of no-brainers. Goodell, you know, I could have chosen a different commissioner, Paul Tagliabue. He's a little bit in the rearview mirror. He's been gone since 2006 when he retired. So Roger was the obvious third person. He was chosen by Jerry and Robert, among others, to be commissioner. And Roger has really taken NFL to a whole nother level. He's kind of helped elevate it and turn it into a media company as much as a football league.
the team owners in every sport, especially the NFL, they say who the commissioner will be. So there kind of is this symbiotic relationship of this uber multi-billion dollar industry between the team owners, who are also really rich, the vast majority of them, and Roger Goodell.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I think there's a misperception that the commissioners are like CEOs. You know, they're the ones that stand at the top of the pyramid. They're the ones that sort of give the direction to the company and sort of order people left and right. And to a certain degree, commissioners do that. But in the NFL's case, more than every other league, it's much more of an owner-driven league. It has been since its very outset. And so all the major decisions that the league makes, whether to play more games overseas, whether to do partnerships with gambling companies, the tush push, that's the latest controversy du jour. You know, that all comes from the owner committees, whether it's player safety, whether it's the international committee and so forth. And Roger takes his cue from them. So there's an astute former NFL executive who said, Roger is not a CEO type. He may appear to be because he's the face of the league, but he's really a Senate majority leader. He's the guy gathering votes. You need 24 out of the 32 owners to agree to any major change. And so he's listening to them, basically, and taking his cue. And some are no-brainers. Some, you know, groups and most of the owners are on board with, but others are more contentious, the tush push being one of them, believe it or not. So he listens to the room. He gathers votes. And then he will advocate. So it's not that Roger doesn't have his own ideas. It's just that they're not in front. He's taking his cue from where the owners sit.
Ken Belson is the guest. Name of the book, Every Day is Sunday, How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL into a Cultural and Economic Juggernaut. Ken, I'm in my 60s, grew up, started watching sports, including pro football, on Sundays. We had the 1 o'clock game and the 4 o'clock game. And, man, Monday Night Football was uber big. Now it's almost every day, hence the title of your book, Every Day is Sunday. When did that happen? And is it so big, Ken, because there are so few games compared to other leagues?
Yeah, you've tapped into exactly it. There's scarcity demand, right? You have 200 and, well, back in the day, if we sound like we're about the same age, there were 14 regular season games. Mm-hmm. Then it went to 16. Now it's 17. The NFL wants to go to 18. But that's still not a ton, right? I mean, basically, they cram their season into the fourth quarter of the year, from Labor Day to New Year's Eve, and obviously the winner-take-all playoffs in January. But it's a pretty short season, and yet, even in that calendar, they try and bunch the games into Thursdays. Now we got two Monday night games and Sunday. But so they've been deliberate at not trying to oversaturate us with games the way, say, baseball necessarily has to do just because of their schedule. Mm-hmm. So that scarcity demand is one of the linchpins of their strategy. The other is making sure most of their games are on over-the-air free channels, Channel 2 in New York, yep. CBS, Channel 5 and Fox. Most of their games are still available for anybody with rabbit ears or a cable connection. There are a lot of complaints, understandably, about the subscription services, the games on Peacock. There was a playoff game last year. The Christmas games are going to be on Netflix. I think the NFL is trying to tiptoe into that world slowly. I think the other leagues have moved faster. Even it's not going to stop people from complaining. They're not going to get their football. But by and large, 90% of the games are still on free TV, and that's no other league is like that.
Yeah, and now we have the Sunday morning games, or my Jets played one earlier in the season. I wouldn't call that a game, but it was something resembling football. I'm in therapy, Ken, believe me. On Sundays, let me ask you something. I have a feeling that eventually the NFL will have a European division, a Euro division. Can you see that? Is that the next wave of big NFL expansion? Because I think it's out there. And are they telling us that, Ken Belson, or not?
Well, there's a couple of problems, or not problems, hurdles to getting there. One is just simple math. Anytime you expand the league, you dilute the revenue sharing that the other owners get. So right now there's 32 teams. They get somewhere in the neighborhood of $11 to $12 billion a year and revenue split 32 ways. If you add two or four teams and put them in Europe or, frankly, anywhere else, now you're splitting the money 36 ways. So the existing owners are going to want to be compensated for the money they're not going to be making. Nobody should cry for them, by the way. I mean, they're making plenty of money. But you're diluting their equity in the league. So the franchise fees for those new clubs, whether they're, say, in London and Berlin, for instance, you know, they're going to have to be astronomical in the many billions of dollars just to enter the league. And then the league, you know, is not it doesn't want to just go. You have one chance to go to these cities, right? So you want it to work. So that means there has to be a media package that makes sure these games are generating annual revenue for the other owners. And you have to have a really good stadium. They do in London, the Tottenham Stadium, where the Jets and Broncos approximated football the other day. But, you know, that's a big ask. Then you have the logistical issues. If you're playing in London, you're the London Jets, for instance, and your middle linebacker gets breaks his leg or something on a Sunday, you got to go find a middle linebacker. In America, what you do is you get your GM and you call six or seven free agents who are mostly working out in Texas or Florida, Arizona. You fly to that NFL city and you give them a workout either late Monday or Tuesday morning. And then you take one of them and you put them on the roster and they play the following Sunday. It's a little hard to do that in London with the time zones, the extra flights. To be honest, most NFL players don't even own passports. I mean, you know, they're in their 20s.
Sure.
Most of them hadn't. So there's a lot of logistical hurdles. As Clark Hunt told me for the book, you know, when I asked him the same question, he said, "We won't get there until we have supersonic travel."
Wow.
You know, when it's 3 hours, when it's 3 hours from New York to London, you know, no different than, say, flying to Denver, that's when it's more feasible. Still not entirely practical, but feasible.
Yeah. Final question, Ken Belson. And again, the book is Every Day is Sunday, How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL into a Cultural and Economic Juggernaut. If somebody came up to you, Ken, and said, "Ken, you've been a writer for so many years, write a couple of paragraphs for me about Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, the NFL owner." The NFL owner is what?
A showman, is deliberate, is leaving no money, you know, on the table, generally speaking, and is entirely devoted to football. We may think as fans that they're in it only for the money, as I said, but they, most of them actually really do love football, but they are businessmen with bills and bills to pay. And by gosh, they're going to find ways to make money off the every single game. And frankly, everybody's interest in football.
Folks, pick it up. Great read. Every Day is Sunday, How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL, into a Cultural and Economic Juggernaut. New York Times writer Ken Belson. Hey, Ken, it's been a blast. Thank you, sir. Appreciate the time. Be good.
All right. Hang in there.